Hey guys, how's it going? Scott here from Scott's Bass Lessons, and I'm back with another episode of the SBL podcast for you. If my voice sounds like an octave lower than normal, it's because I've just had a ridiculously heavy day yesterday, and I've woken up feeling like death, utter death. A 17-hour day yesterday. Most of it, unfortunately, which was spent in the car. I did like 9 hours in the car, but I was down at a drummer's house called, well, not house, well, it was his house actually, but his studio as well, a drummer called Gavin Harrison. You'll have probably heard Gavin play on, man, he's played with so many bands, Incognito, Porcupine Tree, King Crimson, Lisa Stansfield. You know, he's played with a host of different artists. And I was down at his place recording a course focusing on metric modulation, odd time signatures, implied time signatures, implied time changes, and a host of other things. It was a real fantastic day, and it was a real honour actually hooking up with Gavin, because I've been geeking out over his stuff for years, like literally since I was like 16. I can remember reading one of his drum books when I was 16 years old and freaking out over some of the concepts in there. So it was an honour to be able to get together with Gavin and record a course for bass players, because it's going to be fun for you guys. So if you're an Academy member over at Scott's Bass Lessons, make sure you keep a lookout, because that is coming to the course library very soon. Now, on with today's guest, who again is another player who's played with a host of artists that you're going to have heard of before. Today we've got the amazing Trevor Barry with us, who is one of the top session players, bass players over here in the UK. And like, seriously guys, his CV is redonkulous. Over the years he's played with the likes of Freddie Mercury, Phil Collins, John Bon Jovi, Elvis Costello, Cat Stevens, Shirley Bassey, Annie Lennox, Rufus Wainwright, Burt Bacharach, Celine Dion, shall I go on? Robbie Williams, James Morrison. And on top of that, then there's like all the West End shows that he's done, movie soundtracks including James Bond's Casino Royale, the TV work that he does. I know right now he's doing Strictly Come Dancing over here in the UK, and he's had that gig for, I think, for almost 12 years. So if you've had any aspirations of becoming a session player, session bass player, or you want to know more about that world, then this podcast is for you. So on that note, I'm going to hand over to Nick and this week's guest, the amazing Trevor Barry.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the SBL podcast. We've got Trevor Barry with us today. And if you don't know who Trevor is, he's kind of the definition of the sideman, session artist, all-round bass player. Just looking at your CV, Trevor, it's just phenomenal, the amount of work you've done in the studio, live, on TV, in theatres. Just, I don't know where to start, man. I'm looking through it now that you've recorded with guys like Phil Collins, Celine Dion, Beverly Knight, Elaine Page, Robin Williams and Jim Carrey we've got here, George Benson, David Essex, and then live we've got Shirley Bassey, Freddie Mercury, Rod Stewart, Guy Chambers, Robbie Williams, Brian May, Hamish Stewart, Annie Lennox. In TV and films, work on Notting Hill and James Bond theme for Casino Royale. You're doing the Strictly Come Dancing show right now, which you've been doing for how long?
That's got to be coming up 12 years.
It's just incredible, Trev. How do you do it?
It's just being old. You get old, you get a long list. The older you get, the longer your list.
But how did it all start? I mean, it also says here that you got your first sort of early gigs at Ronnie Scott's and at Abbey Road Studios when you were just 15 years old.
Well, my first ever studio date, which, I mean, I got paid, so it was I was playing guitar. My first instrument was guitar.
Right.
And I changed about 16. At 15, I was playing banjo Aladdin,
right,
in the Lyric Theatre, Hammersmith, and it was Sandy Wilson who wrote the, you know, the, is it a boyfriend or something? But anyway, it was 3 hours long, and it was and they did a cast down. So my first session was in Abbey Road One, at 15 years old, and you know, I remember my mum dropping me off there and at 8 o'clock in the morning for a 10 o'clock start and being throwing up in the toilet.
Really?
I'm afraid, yeah. With nerves, you know. So
even at that age, you were kind of aware of the legacy of that studio?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, I'm brought up on the Beatles. Beatles were my life.
Right.
I was mad keen on the Beatles from day one, you know. So all of my life from 62 all the way through the Beatles, you know, when they split up, you know, the sort of late 60s, early 70s, 71, I think it was, I was devastated, you know. I was like, Take That fan, you know, I was crying, sure. You know, couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
Blamed Yoko, did all the thing. But, you know, so I was well aware of Abbey Road. And from 16 years old, I got a job with a cabaret band going to Norway for three months, I think it was, playing in a hotel, and the bass on what after that gig, the bass player left, and the band leader said, "Do you want to play bass?" And I said, "Well, yeah, great." And that was at the String of Pearls, Wembley. We played for, because I couldn't read music at the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And through doing that job, I it was back in cabaret, like two or three cabarets a night. So I got my reading together through there. And there, funny enough, there was a keyboard player called Dave Hartley, who's written with Sting and is Oscar nominated, is now. But then he was just Dave Hartley from Cleckheaton, and he was and it was his first job. And his dad was Bob Hartley, the head of music for Yorkshire Television.
Right.
So a year later, Bob gave me my first what we call a proper pro session on bass for a TV show, 3-2-1. So through there, I met Harold Fisher and Paul Keogh and Trevor Brown, Derek Watkins, and all the studio A team that were doing everything, which led on to word of mouth for me going on to doing working for Alan Ainsworth and doing other record dates and TV shows. You know, so that's how, you know, I sort of lucked into it. It's word of mouth, mm-hmm. And you sort of one job leads to another. If you're a young musician and you get the okays from the older guys. You know, your temperament's right, you can read, you turn up right, you've got the right sort of gear. That sort of, back in the early 80s, you were made, because there were so many musicians on TV shows and so many TV shows being made, and all the advertising budgets were through the roof. So, mm-hmm. You know, I was doing three jingles a day, you know, and that was constant for years. So, you know, it was much easier than it is now, because there's just not the budget, so there's not the work. You know, so I fear, like a lot of my, you know, my friends and bass player Steve Pearson, what we talk about, there's a lot of worry about the state of young players coming through. Where are they going to get the knowledge from to cover all bases and do all jobs? Because there's some phenomenal young players mm-hmm. around, you know, and you think, well, how are they going to? They're going to make a living, you know. You know, as time goes on, you know, I get asked all the time.
Well, the landscape has definitely changed, hasn't it?
Oh God, yeah. The session scene now is nothing. It's hardly a session scene, I would say. I mean, now if I get two a week, I'm swamped. You know, like so I'm. You know, people ask me, "Am I busy?" And I go, "Yeah, I've got two." You know, and that's so. You know, how younger guys get on. I fear for them, you know. But it'll come around. It's cyclical, isn't it? This the music business, I believe, you know. Because at one stage, it was all drum machines, or lifter, all that, you know, all drum machines and all synth bass.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's come back again. Now it's live music and recording live, which is great, you know, with a band in a room. That's coming back. Just the unfortunate thing is, there's either loads of money for major artists or no money for small artists, you know. So I don't know. Is that the answer to the one question?
I'm just really curious about it, really. I mean, certainly the generation you were in, you got the chance to play so much before really knowing where you were going to go next.
Yeah. Well, I didn't realise you could make a living at this. I thought I wanted to be John Lennon.
Right.
And next thing you know, I've turned into being a sideman or whatever you want to call it, you know, and love it. And people keep asking you as you grow up, you know, what music do you like? Like, well, I love all of it, you know. I love it, you know. What's your favorite? Well, my favorite right now, or the favorite yesterday, or
sure.
You know, the music, it doesn't move me as much, but it doesn't mean it's classical music doesn't get to me. The rock and roll does, you know. So crunch chords hit me more than
sure.
that, or even a Billy Joel ballad, or something, you know, anything Elton John, you know. So that sort of stuff cracks me more than the classical element of it. Although,
just thinking back to when you were back at the String of Pearls in Wembley, was there a point there where your bass playing was getting better?
Well, yeah, that's debatable. Well, you have an arrogance of you were, you know, I at that stage as an 18-year-old. I wearing my Music Man bass up around my neck because I was looking at Mark King, you know, trying to work out how you do the how you get that together, you know. So I was, and you have an arrogance of when you go and see a band or anything, you look at it and you go, well, I can do that, you know, I can do that, I can play, I can do. Why am I not doing that gig? Why am I not? You know, you're not doing that gig because you're not asked to do it. Because you're not good enough to do it, you know. So it's you know, it takes a good. I think you have to have that arrogance to get good at what you're doing, to get good at the playing the actual instrument, to sit in there and woodshop. I mean, I never had a bass out of my hand from 16 years old to 24. I was always watching. If I was watching telly, I was playing the bass. I had a natural affinity with it. I wasn't a choppy player. But I could play just about anything. If we all learning John Patitucci lines at one stage, or Got a Match and all that. Going through all those things, and you had to learn it. So okay, I'm going to play that. So just to make sure you could, you know. So, and you had that constant fear of doing a session where you thought you were going to get caught out. You know, you couldn't be out of place. Someone's going to put some music on in front of you. You're not going to be out of play. You know, but the as a young bass player, the String of Pearls. I was doing what everyone did. I wasn't taking it serious. I was, you know, if it wasn't serious jazz or funk or rock, or I wasn't interested. You know, I was playing Country Roads, slapping Country Roads, all sorts of messing about. And a guitar player called Kenny Shaw said to me, we were doing some gig in London, in the West End, some function. And I thought, oh, this is beneath me, you know, what am I doing? You know, and I wasn't taking it seriously. And Kenny said to me, look, man, if you don't want to be here, don't be here, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I'm enjoying it. And I tell myself, well, wait a minute. He's right, you know. Either you take the music seriously at all levels and make it as best as you can be, or don't turn up, you know. So that's very much how I am now. I try never to put myself in a position where I'm going to turn into that arse again.
Yeah.
And you know, and not take something seriously and not make something as best as I can be, you know. If I don't want to be there, I won't be there. And there's been sessions where I've gone, you know what? I don't think I'm what you need. You know, I don't think I'm giving you whatever you want. You know, I don't think I'm right for you. You know, and that's the way that's another thing you learn as you grow up. You know, because everyone wants to be loved as a player. Everyone wants to go, yeah, I could do that and do a good job, and everyone goes thumbs up. Sometimes, you know, some people don't like the way you play, or don't like the way you look, or the way you. Where you come across in the studio, you could say one word and someone gets the arse, you know. And because of just the way I look and so, I've had sessions. I've been lucky. I've done sessions with like guys from Iron Maiden and all that, and they come into the studio and saw me and go, "Geez, what have we got here?" You know, and I've seen them go back up the stairs into the control room. This particular thing I'm thinking about is in Lounsdown Studio, which is no longer there. Came in, and there was a conflab going through in the control room, and you know, and then we came down, we played a few tunes, and then it's fine, you know,
it's gonna work, you know? yeah
so but a lot of players, a lot of producers, especially TV people, listen with their eyes, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's preconceptions. Yeah.
So you have to be aware of that. Again, it doesn't matter so much for me now because I'm towards the arse end of my cycle in the game, you know. But you know, so I can just say, I'm happy not to turn up, or I'm, you know.
Would you say it's more important to have a good relationship with other musicians that you might bump into regularly on sessions? I know you work a lot with Ian Thomas and guys like that. Or do you think it's important to have, do you put more energy into building a relationship with the guys booking you, like the producer?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you can't fake who you are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're a dick, you're going to get found out and you're not going to be friends. The things are, but producers, generally speaking, if they get on with you and get on with their playing, I mean, the sessions that we get, like Yanto pass on to me or Steve pass on to me or vice versa, are because we all get on or have respect for us. We know that, I mean, none of us will ever recommend someone that we can't stand by.
Sure.
You know, I get a lot of guys say to me, oh, can you get, you know, put me up for this? And I go, well, I don't know you or you're playing well enough to do. But, and there's other guys that I've met and I've seen do nothing. I've worked with, I've done, oh, this is great. You know, if you need a guitar player or you need a drummer or another bass player, give this guy a call if you can't get who you want, you know. But yes, yeah,
so producers do come to you often asking for your recommendations. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're on a studio date and, you know, or someone's booking you for an album and you can't do it, or you can't do one of the days and they can't get who, most producers have one to however many, but in my experience, it's been one to three.
Yeah.
There's three guys, maybe five guys for every instrument that are their first call. That's too many. Three or four. And after that, it's a bit, okay, then you go on the list, you know, so then you work your way up the list and that comes by generally people they used to working with. So if Yanto or I or Neil Wilkinson or Ralph or anyone says, put this guy on, you know you're going to get someone who can do the job, you know.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about it, yeah.
So that's how they get on. But like I say, as we were saying earlier, years ago when there was a load more work, that was a lot more prevalent. Now, there's not so much. So 9 times out of 10, one of the top three guys on the list will get the call, you know, be able to do it, you know.
What would you say are the kind of the best bits you've enjoyed about working on TV, particularly a show like Strictly the Come Dancing show, where you're on TV, you can't escape it. Once the take's done, it's out there, which is so different to playing live, isn't it?
Oh yeah. It's a, you know, I'm trying not to, cause it's every musician in that band at the top of their game.
Absolutely.
Phenomenal players. And they're, and you know, you have to take in consideration that your lead is plugged into a board that's going out and 12 million people are listening.
A lot of people. Yeah.
And if you don't play, say if you've got, there's been things when that I've had the pickup, you know, I've had the first eight bars on them, or any one of us, a lot of keyboards and there's vocalists are phenomenal. And if you don't play, once you get the downbeat, you know, the dancers don't dance. And they're looking around for who's messed up.
Yeah.
That comes to the MD. And that's my goodbye. You know, that's, you won't catch me on it again. You know, but everyone's still only as good as their last
show. Right.
But the challenge of it is fantastic. You know, it's just to turn up and try and, I have no idea what we're playing this week. So I'll turn up on Friday night, the rhythm section and the singers will get together. And Dave, we have, 3 hours. It's all MU BBC rates. Mm-hmm. MU Musicians Union and the BBC have a special rate. So we have 3 hour rehearsal with a 15 minute break to go through all the charts with the rhythm section and the singers to get as much as we can. And Dave's very demanding. Mm-hmm. Dave Archer is, he makes sure all the sounds are right. We've all got effects things that we have to use, and the guitar players in particular. And the synth sounds and the, you know, all that stuff, and the drum sounds, because Brett has to play electronic drums and as well. So, and that we get two and three quarter hours to go through that on Friday, and then on Saturday morning, as has been last week. We've been at 8:30 in the morning for an 8:30 downbeat with the whole band. And then we only get 15 minutes to play as a whole band before we're on camera rehearsals with the dancers for the very first time. So it's a, you know.
Yeah, you've got to be on the ball.
Yeah, but when you've done it for so long, see, what I'm trying to do is project back to how I used to feel. And it's scary as.
You know? Yeah.
But I mean, and also, you know, I remember one making a mistake, because you don't know who's watching. And I mean, it's like we're very much a window for all live musicians, you know, because what you do and what other guys do, you know, is we're all in the same boat. And if people see us doing well, and they go, oh, whoa, that band's pretty good, then maybe we can have a band on our show, or we should have.
Exactly.
And
yeah, yeah.
It makes a difference. So we don't take it for granted, and we're all very aware of that, you know. So that's why when we do as good a job as we do, you know, subjectively.
You do a fantastic job, mate, yeah.
But, I remember playing one week we had Sir Duke to play. Now, I know it so well, but I've never played it before. So, and worse than that, I've never read it before. Mm-hmm. And I've learnt it. So we're going to play it, it's in B, and you go, dum da 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 da. No, I've never played it. I'll go, dum da 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 da. Because that's just the way I thought. Well, it's too hard to go. So I've never thought of it. Of course, I'm reading it, and I have to play da da da. And so we did that tune, and I missed a top note on something. And when I put my phone on in the car on the way home, I had about 15 text messages from Ian Thomas, was one of them. Everything all right, Trev? You know. So I got, you get a load of stick from your mates, but I expect it, and it's I know where it's coming from, so it's cool, you know.
How do you then find it switching back to say you're booked to do a tour or something like that?
What?
Just changing roles.
Yeah, the tour.
Or changing environment.
Touring is a. It's like TV on when you're really stoned, because it's just goes for on forever. Everything takes forever.
Yeah.
Instead of we've got 3 hours to do to get together this TV show. On a tour, you'll have anything from 2 weeks to a month, or in some cases longer, to rehearse the same 20, 25 tunes you're going to play for the next year, or whatever, you know. So that's a whole different discipline. And I've never been a great, I don't remember tunes very well, unless they're really good tunes.
Sure.
So I normally keep, I've got an iPad, and I've had one for years that I keep on a little standby down by the monitor. So, which is really bad, because, you know, but it's just, for me, it's the way I can keep myself focused on not messing about, you know, giving the job due respect for.
Do you think that's a kind of a result of having read music for so long? Like sometimes when you're in a cabaret band or something like that, I've done it in the past, you become so reliant on the charts.
Yeah.
That sometimes you don't really, you find it difficult to get it all in your head again.
Very much so. Very much so. I mean, and that's how it is for me. I for that very, very, very reason, you become reliant on it. Mm-hmm. But then again, like in some bands I play in, the guys don't use charts and stuff, and they make loads of mistakes.
Exactly. Yeah, sure.
The thing is, being a bass player, if you make a mistake, everyone knows, because the harmonic structure, everything falls, you know. So whereas a guitar player can play a wrong, or a keyboard, tops, anything with the right hand, you know, they can get away with it. Whereas if you, you know, you have to be solid, you know, especially on, I mean, I worked with Yusef Cat Stevens, and he recorded every gig, you know, and I'm one of the only guys, and that band's phenomenal, Kwame Yeboah and Eric Apapule and Yanto did it at the time, and Pete Adams.
Great,
it's a great band, you know. And Yanto and I were the only ones that sort of cheated a little bit with that. But we never made a mistake, you know. I'm not saying Kwame did or Eric did, because they don't. But they're gifted that way, man. They're that sort of player that can learn. And they sing it. And that's another, those particular guys. They remember complex harmonies, vocal harmonies, and play complex parts. Yusef's music is really, you know, it's odd bar signatures and or time signatures and bar lengths more than anything else is to get me.
Yeah.
So, you know, but so yeah, it, so I can't. I admire people that can listen to something and remember something. You know.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay. You mentioned Ian Thomas there again, who you work with. I've seen you on lots of gigs with.
Yeah.
How important is it, or how much of a difference does it make having someone like that who you've got such a history with and such an understanding of how they play that you can sort of navigate your way around gigs a bit easier?
Yeah, we don't have to speak. You know, we just start playing, and it's always great. You know, it just feels great. We smile when we play, but it does. Any of those groups, again, there's Yanto, there's Neil Wilkerson, there's Ralph Salmins, there's Jeremy Stacey.
Sure,
probably left a couple out. But if they turn up on a day, I'm good, you know. I don't have to, I'll go, oh, okay, it's going to be easy today, you know. But then I worked with a younger guy a couple of months ago at Abbey Road, and I've never met before, and he was fantastic. You know, I won't mention him because I don't want to embarrass him, but he laid it down, was great, you know. So, and I like playing. I put a band together to do Earth, Wind & Fire stuff. And permanently with guys that I don't normally play with. Because I question, you know, I question myself.
Sure.
You know, I want to put myself in different environments to see if I can still do it, you know.
And what's the conversation like before a gig like that, where perhaps you don't know the guy so well?
Well, I mean, it's just what it normally is. I'm very much a watcher, and because it all sounds rubbish, but because I've been around for so long, most people know or have heard of me in the environments I've been in anyway, and so they're sort of a bit, again, because I'm old, I guess, so they're a bit more, you know. I don't know what the phrase is, forgiving or whatever it is. They're sort of watchful of me as well, you know. But that's how it should be. You should treat people with respect. Find your way in. You know, for some people tell me I'm very difficult. So people that I know now said when I first worked with me said you're really scary.
Really?
But yeah, but I don't mean to be. But as I said to them, I said good, because then you're a great player, you know, and maybe I quietened you down a little bit, you know, maybe I dampened your exuberance to want to impress anyone, because if anyone's trying to play a lot, if I'm playing with anyone and they're playing a lot, I'm playing nothing.
Sure. You know,
I'm playing football, so I'm playing just long notes and going, okay, come on, I'm not in competition with anyone. So if someone wants to showboat, I'll let them go, you know, and then they soon realise. There's been times when I've stopped playing on gigs. If there's too much going on, I just stop playing, because there's no need for me to be there.
Right.
It's too much noise. It's too much. Everyone's. There's no air in the music. Then I don't want to play. Let me tell you a story about that. So this is, Anthony Jackson's a bit of a hero of mine.
Sure. Yeah.
And years ago, there was a surprise gig at the Dominion, I think it was, with Lee Ritenour's band, and Anthony turned up with Alex Acuna. And at the end of the gig, they did this blues, right? And it started off with like just a collar thing, and Lee Ritenour on an acoustic guitar was just vamping over some chords. And then they went into this blues, and I thought, and Anthony was sitting down, and I was going to play just where I was going to play, and he didn't play. And I thought, and I said, I saw him after. I said, I just want to say I'm a big fan, you know. And you know, can I ask you, why in that blues, why didn't you play? He said, it sounded good, didn't it? I went, yeah. He said, well, you know, I couldn't add anything to it. It sounded good.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's another lesson, in particular for studio work. Don't be scared. If something sounds good,
don't force it. Yeah,
don't try and get in on it, you know, just for the sake of it. You know, it's all about the end result. It's all about the song. It's all about the tune on our gig. You know, it's not about, you know, I got caught up when I used to play in a Morrissey Mullen band,
mm-hmm.
and get a bass solo, and Jim would shift it into E, and off I went, all up, you know, giving it all that, and the crowd loved it. You know, and I was, And I thought, oh yeah, I'm really good. You know, I don't know what it is. And Miles Davis was it said? He said, if you play for applause, that's all you get.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's a great lesson to get. You know, it starts with, you know, quiet down. Just like doing things for effect. If you're overplaying, if you're just playing to get in something or get in that riff or do some tap or whatever, if you, you know. It's, you know, it goes over. The same thing goes over if you go into music shops. Or I love, you know, we've met before at the Bay Centre weekends when I've been Piers coming to Avalon, but we can't stand it for too long. It's too noisy, and everyone's going crazy. So I'm on one hand, I'm torn because I love meeting new, especially bass players, because we don't see each other all the time.
Sure.
So it's great to sit and chat and hang out and just. But after an hour, I'm going, oh, Steve, we got to go. You know, it's too noisy. Everyone's just trying to impress. I don't know who they're trying to impress or what they're trying to do. You know, you see them sitting there, they're doing blah, 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 and they're looking up, you know.
Yeah, yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
You can't hear the sound of the amp you want to try or the guitar you want to try and all this stuff. So, but it's a different thing, I suppose. See how old and crotchety I am.
Talking about gear, how much responsibility do you take with the sound of your instrument? When you go, like you say, you just plug into a desk, do you just turn up and let them worry about how it's going to sound when it comes out, or are you really into it?
No, I'm pretty much, if I'm confident I've got a good sound at source, because don't forget, because I've done so many sessions in places like Lime Grove and old BBC places where you could play with the best band in the world and then be in the studios alive with groove and noise, and then you go into listening and the sounds just everything sucked out of it.
Just squashed, yeah.
I've done millions of things like that, so I have to know. Also, you work in some studios where their job is to get, if you're playing with an orchestra and everything live, their job is to get everything on that tape, and then it's going to go to wherever the guy is producing it and mixing it, and it's going to be mixed somewhere. So your sound that you can't hear properly because there's only one monitor send or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you have to know that your core sound is good and they can do everything they want to. And that's happened millions of times to me where I go, I can't hear it. You know, you see, I can't hear it. Man. I go in there in the live room, I can't hear it. I always go into the live room, whether I'm with an orchestra or whatever, just to check that my basic, the basic sound of mine is there, and then I know that they can do anything what they with it, they want.
Sure.
With it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but just I'm not a big gear guy, and I'm not. If you're working for a producer, generally speaking, you're there for because they like what you do, and they can do. I work for Guy Chambers, for instance. The guy always. He always used to give me, he's got a beautiful, I think it's a 64, 66 P bass, and it just feels great. It sounds fantastic. And I pick it up and I always use that when I go in there for him. You know, it's very rarely do I use my own bass, so I always take it. And he said, just, you know, do what you want. But I always pick this thing up, you know, just because I know, I know he loves that sound.
Sure, yeah.
And B, you know, so it's an easy fix for me. I just go, yeah, I know he likes the sound, so I've just got to get the right notes, you know. So,
do you get the same kind of reassurance when you turn up for a session or you're booked for a session? Like you said, you know that there's someone like Ianto on key, you know it's going to be a good gig. But when you're booked by someone like Guy, you think, yeah, this is going to sound great.
Well, I mean, there's, again, I've done so many things for him. I did so much recording for him on the last Robbie album. Mm-hmm. None of it went on the record because they recorded 70 tracks.
Wow, really?
Yeah. Really? So I mean, there's a whole lot. One's a duet. Oh, I don't know if I'm allowed to speak about it because it's not out here. But I always know it's going to be fun. But I know Guy, you know, I know Harry, you know, how he works. So I don't know. Whether you know, on some of that early stuff, there's two bass players. You know, my favourite Robbie track is that one with Kylie.
Yeah,
Kids.
I love that. I know the one. Yeah, it's a good groove, isn't
two,
it?
Yeah, it's two bass players on that. But I did a thing that was Ianto got me involved with Guy, and we turned up to do for Radio 2 a live thing with all of Guy's Robbie tracks for Radio 2. It's about somewhere, but that's how me and Guy got pretty tight because he's very controlling. He likes everything to be the same and everything. So, but he had, I passed an audition on that job. You know what I mean? So from then on, I've done quite a lot. You know, but I know it's always going to be fun. He is Richard Flax's engineer, producer, yeah. And he's great. So we always had a good laugh.
What's it like in that scenario where, it's probably not happened to you very often, but where you've done a session and your track doesn't make the album or something like that? Do you feel sort of crushed by that, or is it just something you just have to take on the chin?
When I was younger, I've replaced loads of bass players, and I'm sure I've been replaced loads of times.
Yeah.
You can't, it's much harder to deal with when you're younger.
Yeah.
Because it's everything. Oh, you're going to be on a record. It's going to be this. And it comes out and you're not on it. And it's, what?
And it's all those questions going, why not on it? Yeah. What happened? Yeah, yeah.
Did I not? It's not that. You know, it's they wanted, there's all sorts of reasons. Some completely not valid, a lot of bullshit. But some, they wanted a different feel, or they changed this, or they wanted a different sound, or, you know, you mustn't be, if you think your first call for everything, or only go to work for if you think your first call, you never go out of the house, you know. You must never be that way. You know, we're all sole traders, aren't we? You know.
Sure. The last thing I want to ask you is about sort of the business side of things, and how prepared you've been for that element of once you've realised you can make a living out of this. How did you go about thinking about, right, I need to invoice for this and stuff like that and get all my paperwork in order. Is that a big side of it? And all that?
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's at the end of the day, you're paying the bills.
It's not always a cool thing to bring up in a session and stuff like that. How does it all work?
It should be.
Right.
It should be. There should be no embarrassment. A good producer would not allow you to be embarrassed, you know? Because our natural instinct is we don't, excuse me, do you mind, you know, it's
not, yeah, yeah.
You know, we've just made art, you've just done this, you know, think of your plumber, you know, you get a plumber around, you got to pay him, right? You know,
sure.
the same job, and it's, you don't be a dick about it, but you, okay, who do I speak to about the invoice details?
Right.
You know. Simple as, you know, and get them off the famous Uniport and absolute, for me, a nightmare to deal with, you know, the things on there for Universal and
sure.
Various record companies that use these things, and that's harder now nowadays because it takes, you know, I've heard stories of 6 months and then closing right. accounts and all this stuff, but unfortunately it never happened to me, thankfully, but you know, it's something you need. Everything must be in place. Make sure if you're getting busy and you're going over the VAT threshold, make sure you get your VAT done before, so you don't have to. Otherwise, you have to invoice back for the VAT.
Yeah, yeah.
And you might not get it, so then you're liable for it. There's all sorts of things that you know a good accountant is worth paying for at any level. You know, and pay your tax.
Yeah. I'm just going to scan over your CV one more time, Joe. If I'm going to pick one highlight from the studio, from live and from TV, starting off in the studio, what's been the real highlight for you, like a particular album or someone you've worked with? Or even playing at a particular studio?
I'm going to say Studio 2.
Yeah.
Abbey Road, because of my... But, I mean, I can't stand a bloody place now because I have to go up down those stairs all the time. My knees are bloody. But the Studio 2, I used to work a lot for George Martin. So Studio 2, George Martin on the board. And the track, one of the tracks I did with Celine Dion was called The Reason, which was written by Carole King. And Carole King was playing piano.
Wow.
And she wanted a picture with the band. None of us would have had the temerity to ask her for a picture, but she wanted a picture with the band. So somewhere, there's a picture of me, Yanto, Robbie Mack, and George Martin and Carole King somewhere, but I can't find it. So that'd be that a memorable studio day.
God, yeah, incredible. How about live?
Live's got to be the Freddie Mercury thing in Barcelona.
Yeah.
And
what do you remember about that?
Well, one of the things I remember most about it is setting up, and we were using. Oh, no, I can't say that story, but we were using another band's back line.
Okay.
And the roadie said, "Oh, after we played for a little bit, said, oh, great, at least we've got some musicians who know how to work it." And then and Freddie coming up on the sound check, going, "No, I think we have bass here." And this here, and just be fabulous, and it was just so cool. And it's Freddie Mercury, man, and it's just and this charisma. Some of the major stars, when they're just normal people, you know, they really are. But you look at them, and I met a few. And Freddie was one of them, and John Bon Jovi. They just like they're wearing the same clothes as you, and they look like a million pounds, you know, and sack of, you know, anyway. So that just really saying, just you, based, we're just stand there, just do the, you know, I just love, you know, that. So that's you know, when he came on stage, you know, 120,000 people in the thing in front of the palace in Barcelona, quite something, you know. Oh, yeah, when you got your in ears on, you got a massive amp behind you, and you're sitting there, and that happens, and you can hear. The crowd, and it was filmed. It was worldwide. It was filmed live, and it was awesome. So it was a moment, you know.
God, yeah. How about some of the film work you've done? I mentioned earlier on the James Bond theme and Elvis Costello track on Notting Hill. I'm thinking of as well.
Oh God, yeah. That, I forgot. Yeah, that was great. That was almost. I think there was two takes that, and then they went down, and put the strings on it. That was at Abbey Road 3, and they were recording the string section downstairs. So they took it straight from upstairs. The James Bond one was great because that was I've always wanted to play that, and I first met Dave Arnold when I was recording an album with Madeleine Pearl, and he was a tape op in a that's Cottage Audio, and he was so helpful and so nice, and this theme session was the only thing I did with him, you know. That's the only thing I've done with him today. That was the only thing I've been able to do. And that was great. Me and Yanto just turned up. They'd been working, doing the James Bond soundtrack all week. And me and Yanto turned up for the last session of the day. I mean, it was a theme. It was just, we loved it. You know?
God, I bet, yeah.
Yeah. And I used to, I didn't have a pick. I lost my pick and there was no guitar in the session. So I to play it with a SIM card for my phone.
No way.
Yeah. So that's on Casino Royale.
Oh, I'm going to try that.
No, you know, needs must, you know, when there's an orchestra waiting.
Having done all this work, Trevor, what's the one kind of thing that you think serves you best? Being able to jump between studio, live, and TV and film, and such variety of artists as well.
I think you have to go in... with the same attitude for all, which is just be open, be nice. You know, if you're with nice people, they don't take advantage. But you've got to stand your ground now and again. You have to make sure that people know you're there, but not by being a dick or being rude. You know, you can do that. You should be able to do that with your presence as a musician by asking the right questions, knowing when to shut up, when to speak, knowing that when something costs a lot of money, you don't want to be the one holding things up.
Sure.
You know. That's about it, really.
That's all there is to it.
That's all there is to it, yeah. Just be nice. Basically, just be nice and make sure you're a badass when it comes to playing, you know.
Trevor, thanks so much for hanging out today, mate. Guys, go and check out Trevor's website, trevorbarrybass.com. Look out for him on Saturday night in the BBC Strictly Come Dancing band, which will be running for a few more weeks yet. And Trev, yeah, thanks. Keep up the great work, man. Massive fan of everything you do.
Oh, you're too kind. It's lovely to speak to you again, man. Speak to you soon.
Okay, guys, hopefully you enjoyed that interview with the amazing Trevor Barry. Huge thanks to Trevor as well for hanging out with Nick and sharing all that cool info with you guys. I know if you're anything like me, I used to geek out about, you know, what it was going to be like being a session musician. And, you know, and that whole world surrounding that. So I think it was a a really, really interesting interview to get an insight into that world. Remember, if you are an Academy member, you can watch the video for that as well. And obviously, if you're an Academy member, you can access all of our course library, the live seminars that we do every single week with some of the best base educators on the planet, the live streams I do, the monthly feedback sessions. You get direct access to me, so you can send me videos and I'll give you direct video feedback. The whole nine yards. So if you haven't been to scottsbaselessons.com yet, go over there and check it out. In a nutshell, we're the ultimate online learning platform for bass players. It's the ultimate online school for, you know, bass players just like you who are trying to get their bass playing to the next level. So I would love if you go check it out, and you can grab a 14-day free trial just to see if it's for you as well. You know, so go over, check it out. And other than that, guys, take it easy, and I'll see you in the shed.